This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs, and today on the show, we're highlighting the good work of the Freedom Film Network, who are releasing a specially curated Freedom Film Fest film playlist every Friday, which they've dubbed Weekend Watch with Freedom Film Fest. So this is going to happen on their YouTube channel, and this week, the playlist is centered on the theme hashtag IPCMCNow and is a collection of films that showcase why an independent police complaints and misconduct commission is necessary to hold those who abuse their power accountable for their actions. So earlier we heard from Seven Doraisamy, who is the executive director of Suara Rakyat Malaysia, Suaram, and the director of the short film Poker Boy. But joining me now is Tricia Yeo, who is the CEO of the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, or IDEAS. And many years ago, Tricia also directed the documentary film titled Rights of the Dead, which looks at the events surrounding the mysterious death of political aide Teo Beng Hock and what transpired after. So we're going to find out more about that film. Welcome, Tricia. Thanks so much for joining me on the show today. I don't know if I'm right in saying this, that, you know, this was a deeply personal story for you, right? It's based on what happened to your former colleague, Teo Beng Hock. Remind us about what this film is about and why you wanted to tell this story.
So thanks for having me here. I wanted to tell this story because the late Teo Beng Hock was someone who worked for an exco member of the Selangor state government, at which I was also working. So I was working for the chief minister, the Menteri Besar at that time, Tan Sri Khalid Ibrahim, and he was working for an exco member called Ian Yong, basically a DAP exco member. And we would see each other. I wasn't close to him at all, actually. I don't think we even had like a long conversation before. So yes, he was technically a colleague, but for me, it represented a generation of young people who included myself, who included him, who had come into the state government, at this new state government, at a point in time at which the desire to make change and to do something meaningful in making a difference to a new government, reforming things, doing things better in a more transparent and accountable manner, like that's what he represented to me. And of course, because I was also part of that generation of young people who wanted to make a difference, it truly, truly impacted me as well as my other colleagues when we heard of his death. So maybe a little bit more background about him as well. Like, so he came from a relatively small family, you know, two siblings. He was a journalist before he worked for Sin Chiu Jit Po. And then again, when the change of government happened, when Pakatan Rakyat took over Selangor in 2008, he was asked to help this exco member out. And he willingly took the job, changed his career path from journalism and moved over into this sort of political aid sphere. And when he was called in to assist in the investigation, so mind you, he wasn't actually the person being investigated, but he was just called into the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission, MACC office, in July of 2009 to assist as a witness and then to hear the news of his devastating fall and therefore death from the MACC headquarters in Selangor. I think that was just a really crucial moment for all of us. It was a real tragic moment in time. And the reason why I wanted to do it, I mean, yes, you're right in saying that it was personal. I was personally involved, actually, in the entire handling of the case at that point in time as somebody who was aide to the chief minister of Selangor. I pushed very hard to ensure that he got the justice that he deserved. And how I tried to do that was to convince the family to ask for a second autopsy and also assist in getting an independent forensic pathologist to come in externally to provide her judgment. And this person eventually came. I think people do remember her name was Dr. Porntip Rojana Sunan. She worked for the Center of Independent Forensic Science in Thailand. So she worked actually for the Thai government.
Yeah.
And she eventually came in and she provided that independent point of view. I think she was the first person who provided an alternative perspective of what potentially had happened to the late Teo Beng Hock. She was the only person, the only forensic pathologist who noticed that there were markings, unusual markings and bruises on the neck of the deceased, which may have implied that there was some damage done prior to his fall, because she said that the markings and bruisings on the neck were inconsistent with falls from height that she had previously investigated in her country. So I was very much involved in bringing all of this together. You know, I was involved in the inquest. And then to have all of that end by the government's Royal Commission of Inquiry stating that Teo Beng Hock was driven to suicide, which was a conclusion that many people, ourselves in the state government, as well as the family and his lawyers included, was a conclusion that we felt was just unjustifiable. And at that point in time when I decided to do the documentary, this was in 2012, right? So this was prior to the court's reversal of that decision. So at that point in time, when I made the documentary, the conclusion by the government was still that he was driven to suicide. And so I really felt compelled that people need to learn this story. People need to know about it, because there has been some level of injustice served. And I felt that the life of a person just cannot be so easily forgotten. And it's not so much about him, really. I think it was more about what does that mean for every young person in Malaysia who comes into adulthood feeling that they want to do something meaningful with their lives, and to have the system, this gargantuan system that's so mathematically skewed against you. And I felt that this would not be something that augurs well for the future. And what kind of hope does that remove from people if they were not able to see that institutions could actually stand up for them when the crucial time was really needed? So I guess in short, I wanted his story to be told so that people would not forget.
Yeah. And you called it the rights of the dead, right? Because you did want, am I right again in saying that you wanted some justice, you know, for him and for his family, and I guess all of you that were involved in this case as well?
Yes. I mean, I think the more I did research into the subject, the more and more I actually felt connected to others who had also died in custody. So this is why at the very end of the documentary, it's a short one, so I hope people watch it. At the very end, I sort of drew out into the bigger picture and asked the question about why have there been so many deaths in custody over these many years? And you know, I did feel connected to the family members of people who have had their sons, their children taken away at very young ages with explanations that were not very justifiable. And so really looking at the system and rather than just the individual person. And, you know, there were some powerful moments, right? So I didn't put this in the documentary eventually, but there were some moments where I actually tried to contact the mothers of several victims of death in custody, because I thought that they would actually tell a very compelling story. And I think other activists have now moved beyond, you know, this 2011 was such a long time ago. So some activists have already taken this on and tried to talk to the family members. And I think that the question is, this issue is still at large. It is still yet to be resolved. And I think, yeah, questions still need to be asked about why a death in custody happened.
And when you were making this film, right, who were some of those that you spoke to? So you say you spoke to the mother, you wanted to speak to the mothers, but that didn't quite make it to the final cut. But who did you speak to? And I guess, you know, what were some of your greatest takeaways from those, from what was revealed to you by those that you spoke to?
Yeah, I tried to cast a wide net. I mean, I think as any documentary maker would try to do, like really try to build a picture of the person's life. So that it provides a more holistic perspective. Like it paints the person as a real person as opposed to someone who was, you know, just categorized as, it's very easy to just put your paintbrush and say, okay, this guy was a DAP guy. But no, you know, he comes from a very small family in Malacca. His father is a taxi driver. You know, his mother is a housewife. They're not very well to do. And the family itself, like, was never really into activism. So to see that transformation from someone who comes from this you know, small town, and then the family also having to change their lives completely when this thing happened to their son. So I spoke to the parents. I spoke to the sister. The sister, of course, has now become quite a well-known face in activism. I also spoke to his former colleague from Hsinchu, because interestingly enough, I mean, the colleague actually questioned his motivations to work in politics, because the colleague actually said, do you really want to do that? Because that world of politics can be very murky. It's not like journalism. And he still wanted to go ahead, right? I also spoke to his wife-to-be. I think the story essentially was that he was engaged to be married. In fact, he had a child on the way, and the marriage never took place because he died before that. So I think my documentary is the only time at which this person, the wife, was actually interviewed on camera, because she's actually shied away from most interviews. And it was a very sad moment to hear how she treated the whole thing as well, because she essentially, instead of raging against the system, she completely shut off and did not really want to have anything to do with, it was probably just too painful for her to even read what was happening in the newspapers, because ultimately she felt that the powers were just too strong against her. And that's precisely the kind of feeling that I didn't want to see happening amongst younger people, right? When you feel that all the powers are lined up against you and there's really nothing much that you can do, that sense of helplessness and hopelessness, I think that's the worst possible thing that can happen to any young person. Apart from that, I also spoke to experts. So I flew into Bangkok to speak to Dr. Porntip Rajanasunan again, and to ask her about what had happened and, you know, why she said the things that she did. I also spoke to a former forensic expert here in Malaysia, and he was also of the opinion that the experts could have done a better job, especially in the crime scene investigation, because there were many, many things about the crime scene investigation that were really wanting in nature. There were very, you know, even basic mistakes. For instance, the window, they did not do a DNA swipe test on the windows, even though there were like some markings there. The backpack was actually placed and replaced and put and moved to another location even before the crime scene investigation had been done. So there were lots of little holes here and there in the investigation that which are evident, and I talk about it in the documentary as well. Who else did I speak to? So I also spoke to the lawyers. I spoke to the Selangor State Government representative, Malik Imtiaz, as well as the family lawyer, at that time, Gobind Singh. And I spoke to some of Teo Beng Hock's friends and ex-colleagues, so people who were close to him. People who joined in the state government at the same time, but who were actually very close colleagues and not just myself. I spoke to his former boss, Ian Yong, who was the person who was being investigated for the alleged mismanagement of funds. And I think I'd like to point out as well that the alleged mismanagement of funds was only for a very paltry amount. The allegation at the time was that Ian Yong, as an EXCO member, had wrongly paid 1,500 ringgit for 2,400 flags that were purchased as part of Merdeka Day celebrations. So again, you know, whether or not the investigation and the way that he was held overnight, you know, his handphone and his keys taken away from him as a witness of an investigation of a case that involved that small amount of money, like whether that was commensurate with the treatment that he was given, I think that was another question that a lot of people were asking at that time.
You know, I think myself and probably a lot of people, we've forgotten these details, and just hearing them again, it's so harrowing, you know, such a young life lost over, like you said, it's a very paltry amount, and he wasn't even the person being investigated, you know, and he lost his... It's okay. All right. Sorry, I'm getting a bit emotional. But when you were making the film and, you know, after speaking to them, you know, did it bring any closure to you? Did it, you know, when you spoke to the family or all those others involved after, did it bring any closure to them as far as you know?
I think it's very, very difficult to achieve closure for a case like this. It's been over 10 years and I don't think a family member, especially a parent, who loses a child in that way can really ever achieve closure. I think they just have to settle with themselves that this is something that will never really be addressed. For everyone else, like you said, I mean, it's been so long now, and I think people do move on. For myself personally, yeah, I mean, I still get emotional thinking about it. And I think if I were to watch it again, like, I would actually, you know, feel quite emotional, especially at the end. Is there closure? I don't think so. I mean, it's still something that people, especially those who were involved during that time, would have very, very strong and sharp memories of. I actually wrote about this experience like only 10 years later. So I had a three-part piece in TMI, the Malaysian Insight, or was it the Malaysian Insider? I can't remember now, but it's on my website anyway, about the whole experience and how, you know, I used to have dreams about it, and even the whole experience of bringing Dr. Pontip to Kuala Lumpur was wrought with all kinds of things out of a movie, because I was followed in the car and you know, threatening remarks were made and things like that. So the story, I feel, has not ended, also because the investigation is still open. I mean, the good thing is that the previous administration did reopen the investigations under Section 342 of the Penal Code. But the current government has not given a reply as to whether this has closed yet. So it feels that it will only move if people continue to remind the authorities about the case itself. And most importantly, the people who were responsible for this are probably still around. So I wrote an article in NST 10 years after the case. So this was in 2019, 10 years after 2009. And I wrote about, you know, I can't remember the number now, but I think like 6 or 10 things that the police can immediately do is as part of their reinvestigations, because these are questions that were very clearly spelled out. And like I said, if the people are still at large, many of the officers would still be around, and all you need to do is just call them up again and perhaps even offer those who were not directly responsible a sort of moratorium, and to say that, you know, the government will protect you if you provide answers, and at least the family will have some closure. But again, you know, it's not about just this one case, because there have been other cases as well. Of people who died. Like, there was one man who also died as part of the, there was a customs investigation. So he was a customs officer. And then he also died under mysterious circumstances, and no one has really talked about that. And there have been many other incidents. So I think it's more a case of, can we actually do something about the cases that have not been resolved? And I think the answer is yes, we can certainly do that.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I mean, as you said, you know, there have been hundreds of other deaths in custody before Teo Beng Hock, and there have been so many others since. You know, what do you hope that a film that you made, well, almost 10 years ago, how do you hope that documentary can also bring, you know, some discussion points on what's happening today? You know, we're talking about how we need the IPCMC, for example. You know, there have been so many deaths in custody just these last 2 months, you know. What do you hope your documentary can bring to that conversation as well?
Yeah, it's been 10 years. And of course, for me personally, I'm still in the line of trying to do things to improve the country, right? So I'm still working hard at public policy reforms through a think tank, ideas. And what I've learned is that the method and strategy of doing it also has to come with incentives, meaning that if we want to do change to the police force, we also need to show that it's not about the individual policemen or the police officers that we are trying to target. It's not about them at all. In fact, many of them do such a great job. I just brought my mom for vaccination today, and they all did a wonderful job, you know, checking and so on, helping us through. It's about the system, really. It's about the powers that be who are making decisions at the very top, say, of the police force, who are permitting violence to take place by closing not even one eye or maybe two eyes, even by permitting this to happen without the necessary accountability measures. What you're doing is that you're saying that we as citizens of Malaysia do not have the laws to protect our rights, and this can happen to anyone. So I think it's about thinking about ourselves as individual citizens and whether the systems are there to protect us or are they actually there to erode our rights that exist. I think it's about re-educating the public into thinking about how our institutions, like the police force, like the justice system, can do better for us. So in the documentary, I don't just point to the police, by the way. So it's not just about the police. It's about the institutions of even the MACC. So, you know, the MACC, for example, they had to rethink about how they did things after Teo Beng Hock. So that was one of the silver linings, I suppose, in that cloud, where they changed their SOPs, they refined their rules better. So that's good, but, you know, more can be done as well. So it's about the MACC, it's about the police, it's about the judiciary as well. You know, can the judiciary be independent when they set up, when royal commissions of inquiries are set up, not just for something like death in custody, but for anything at all? So can we see all these institutions as operating independently in a robust way that can protect the rights of citizens? I think that's the message that I want to send. And so the end of my documentary, what I did was, and I really tried to encapsulate this, I took photos of hundreds of Malaysians and I got volunteers to do this. They all like came and I took pictures of them. That was, you know, the days before COVID, so we could all see instead of sending their photos to me virtually. And I used all of these Malaysians' photos and I created a collage to show that all of our images could also have been Teo Beng Hock's image. So I kind of like put that into a picture that showed we're all part of Teo Beng Hock's face to say that it could be any one of us. So yeah, I think that's the message that I wanted to share. And I want to recognize like also Jerome Coogan, who is an artist, and he wrote the song, especially for the documentary. It's a really lovely song. And he wrote the song. So that was a song at the closing of the documentary that was played. And I still like feel very emotional when I listen to it, because it's about, you know, death. And I mean, it's quite cryptic, but anyway, listen to it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I just wanted to say that I'm really thankful for this opportunity with the Freedom Film Festival, because when I did it, it was 10 years after. So it was the 10th anniversary. And I think it was quite meaningful because it was the first time that it was held in a big hall and so on. But more importantly, I want to also share with those who may not know that the documentary was also used as part of the police investigation when the police reopened the investigation in 2019. So this was a very surreal moment for me when the police called me in to help them to assist in their investigations, because I think I know the case quite well now, like going through all the details and the documentation. And it was a very surreal moment because it was in a conference room, that this long table, and the police actually had my documentary on screen in the room. And, you know, I was watching my own face on my own, you know, documentary, and they kept pausing it at certain intervals and asking me questions about it. So it really felt to me like this dream in a dream moment, like an inception moment, where I was watching my film as part of their investigations. And, you know, the police are also featured in the documentary. So I really wonder what they felt about it. And I do hope that they learned something out of all this. But all this to say that, yeah, I think we can do things better. And the family does deserve more than the kind of treatment that they've been given at the moment. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining me today, Tricia.
Thank you, Juliet.
That was Tricia Yeo, who is the CEO of the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, or IDEAS. And she also directed the documentary film Rights of the Dead, which looked at the events surrounding the mysterious death of political aide Teo Beng Hock. So if you'd like to watch that film or any of the other films from this week's Weekend Watch with Freedom Film Fest, just head to the Freedom Film Fest's YouTube page and you can watch them there. Or if you'd like more information, just head to Freedom Film Fest's Facebook or Instagram pages and you can find out more there. And to search for this podcast or any other Live and Learn shows, just head to bfm.my/learn or find them on the BFM app. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Beng Hock was a son, a brother, a husband to be, a father to be, a friend. a Malaysian. It could have been me. It could have been you. It could have been any one of us.
Kau menunggu sesuatu kesilapan di ruang waktu. Kau mencari nadi dirimu. Mungkin ia sedang mencarimu. Imbaskan kembali baki di hati. Hanya kekurangan yang terbukti. Sambungkan semula tubuh yang terpecah. Semua yang terkumbang kepadanya. Maafkan semua yang tak percaya.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.